very good day to you all, and welcome to the Adventures of the Sons of Town Hall. Stories of friendship and fate, of history and harmony, of loss and love. I am Elias B. Worthington, your guide through it all, very excited to dive in and to dive deep. When the boys pushed off for the first time one sweltering summer day in 93, there was nary a soul to bid them farewell. In fact, had there been anyone at the seashore to watch them go, she would have been there to chase them off or to reclaim a debt, certainly not to admire or wish them well. Now, of course, it's quite the different scene. Children run to the water's edge to catch a glimpse of their raft. They beg to climb aboard. They ask if they may, if just for a moment, run a finger along the gentlemen's guitars or even hold their hat boxes. Needless to say, the ladies come now with their painted fans and cheeks aflush. They steal glances. They promise to be there, waiting, should the illustrious pair ever return. When you hear them sing, you'd be forgiven in thinking they'd known each other all their lives. Are they brothers? Twins? Were they in fact singing their silver-throated harmonies inside the womb? Well, the answer to all the above is a resounding no. Indeed, nothing could be farther from the Queen's truth. In fact, it seems nothing short of a gift from on high that these two scoundrels even met at all. Josiah Chester Jones is the swarthier gentleman. He fled the new land and a fallen family whose values or lack thereof he did not share. In the long wake of the war, he sailed against the tides. Oh, hold your horses, Elias. Let me see if I can find the logbook where Josiah describes it himself. No doubt he has a greater way with words than I. It's around here somewhere, I'm sure. Yes, yes, here it is. Now, to find the page. I grew up in Kentucky.
Though my accent is long gone, having traveled as much as I have since I ran away from home. You see, my father, my whole family, really, they fought on the wrong side in the war. Man is just a man, I say. But they all saw it differently. I couldn't stay. I snuck on a ship bound for, well, I didn't know where it was bound for. Turned out it was heading for England, and it was there, among the sacks and the crates below the deck, that I found my voice, singing first to fight off the rats and a horrid seasickness. I was hidden in the dry goods. I'd sing myself to sleep, making up songs about my dream that I might find a kinder life among a gentler people and maybe one day reverse my fortune.
The fairer of the pair was fleeing as well. George Ulysses Brown grew up in the south of England, among the meat scraps and salted carcasses of the family butcher shop. Though born with the gift of song, he was cursed to follow the well-trod path of a long line of first-born sons. Forgive me. I should have prepared my sources earlier, but I have a book of George's somewhere here as well. Just give me another minute. I ran from that loveless
labour of blood and bones, and a world of heavy, heavy expectation. It was always assumed, despite my different disposition, that I'd work beside my old man, who'd work beside his old man. Really, that was the only thing I knew I'd never do. But escaping was easier said than done. The reality was so, so terrifying. I'd rather not write it down in the hope that I'll one day forget just how hard it was. But eventually, I got away from that violent man and my infirmed mother.
I was born in the wake of war. My daddy lost all he was fighting for. But I never agreed with what he believed. I'm the son of a butcher man. The blood ran thick through both my father's hands. I was always afraid when the work was through. I said, blow, wild winds blow, Lord, you know, I've been sinking low. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, wild winds blow me far from home.
Though it didn't seem so at the time, escaping proved the easy part for each of them. Set free from the bonds of their respective families and overwhelmed by a sudden freedom, each succumbed quickly to temptation. As of yet unaware of the other, their parallel paths were astonishingly similar. Each bounced along a succession of temporary jobs, arriving late and often lost in a daydream, always whistling a tune and seeking a laugh before bothering to strain a muscle. Out of respect for their privacies, I will spare many details, but suffice to say, each dipped often into the thieving life, landed on the barroom stool, flopped onto the brothel bed, slumped along the back alley. They stooped low. They racked up debt. They went hungry. They became enemies to many. They were friends to precious few. Sure, it turned out both could sing, but what good was a song when there was no bread upon the table? Indeed, what good was a song when there was rarely even a table at all? Well, one balmy autumn evening by the St. Catherine's docks, both found themselves eyeing the same dancer at Turner's Old Star public house. Now, both Josiah and George fell for this dance hall queen with those big green eyes and those free-falling red curls. Naturally, George assumed she fancied him, whilst Josiah was convinced it was he she admired. They were romantics, after all, always betting on the long odds in a card game, always seeing the best possible scenario, despite all evidence to the contrary. Well, she had eyes for neither.
I was pretty sure she was looking at me, and to be honest, I was excited.
And yet I was totally convinced she was looking at me. But little did either of us know is that she had one eye on the teapot, and the other eye firmly on the chimney stack.
When I realized that she wasn't looking at me, I went at George.
He scooped up, right at me, almost like a cobra would come at you.
It's a move I learned in Kentucky.
I responded quickly, and because of my training on the rugby field, I was able to bring my knee up, which hit his jaw with some force.
I came right back at him again, low.
It was like a pair of arms had grown up out of the floorboards.
It's the move I used against my big brothers back in Kentucky.
If you imagine someone being surrounded by a swarm of bees and panicking, it was very similar to that.
We tumbled around for a while, and I landed a number of blows squarely in his jaw.
And I was concentrating more on his offal.
We had amassed quite a crowd watching us, I think very impressed with some of my moves, and I was sure that she was among the crowd ready to go home with me.
That was when we realized she'd left the pub, having no interest in either of us.
The brawl was more fast than frightening, for neither was much of a fighter. A torn scarf here, a ripped trouser there, but certainly no spilled blood or blackened eye. And then, amidst the scuffle, a strange shift occurred. Whilst tumbling around in the sawdust, they began to sense an undeniable similarity in disposition, a sympathetic energy, an obvious kinship. Despite the difference in accent, in hair colour, in mannerisms, there was an astonishing sameness of spirit. They couldn't help but crack two broken-tooth smiles. They helped each other up, brushed the dirt from each other's beards and breeches, and then, without paying their tab, they strolled out the door. George and Josiah walked and talked for most of the remainder of the night. They began to dream up a wild plan. A plan which would no doubt have stopped my old ticker dead in its tracks simply upon the hearing. But not those two. No. Their eyes lit up like the stars of the Southern Cross. Oh, to have been able to listen in on that tectonic platonic conversation. One can only imagine the sense of discovery, of connection, of sweet relief as they talked of their dreams and their hopes, as lifelong loneliness cracked and fell away, as they began to hatch a plan to sail the seas for the new land.
George, it's time to leave.
Yeah, this can't be another one of those times in my life where I've felt the pull and just not done anything about it.
If you're in, I'm in. Hell, I could leave right now.
But how?
We build a boat.
Thus, the notion of building a raft of scrap and junk was born. Never in recorded nautical history had this been tried before. It's the kind of reckless genius only possible from those not tethered to reason, not encumbered by rationality. It's a project only possible for dreamers, believers, or rather, by madmen. You see, despite the boys' lack of any relevant skills or experience, the great ocean would not intimidate them. Nothing could intimidate them. Those two ultimately came to believe so wholeheartedly in their half-formed vision that with just the flotsam and jetsam found, gathered and lashed together, they built something capable, at least in their minds, of crossing that vast and violent expanse. I found a list with a partial inventory of what they used to build their boat. It's an incredible assortment, really. Let's hear a bit from it, shall we? 2 pounds halfpenny nails.
A broken oak barn door.
A hatchet, 10 feet of cedar board. Hope.
A needle and thread. 12 shackles. A dream.
Coil of rope. A handsaw. Some wax.
8 yards of linen cloth. A 6-foot pine wood box.
3 whiskey barrels, a patchwork quilt, 2 buckets of pitch.
Well, she looked awful and wonderful at the same time, like something a child might have dreamt up. And when George and Josiah pushed off, they couldn't help but laugh at the absurdity of the endeavour. Though neither was much of a reader, they noticed a few nautical miles off the rocky shores of England that burned into a length of driftwood near the prow of this ramshackle ship were the words, "Son of Town Hall."
This is how we build it. This is how we build it. It's how we build a boat.
We didn't have any idea what Son of Town Hall meant. We still don't. But it seemed historic, important, biblical almost.
And so that's what we christened our weird and wonderful vessel, Son of Town Hall. And that's what we clung to during those horrible weeks and months that were to come.
Seemed only natural then that when it came to name our duo, we would be the Sons of Town Hall.
For we were, in a sense, reborn on that raft, and we owed her our lives.
This is how we build it. This is how we build it. It's how we build the boat.
The crossing was utter hell. It is a true miracle that they didn't die. Neither George nor Josiah turned out to be a strong swimmer. Wash days were near fatal affairs. Neither was much of a fisherman either, so the eating was scarce and rarely tasty. And forget about navigation. Was it an act of God that kept them alive and delivered them? It's at least worth asking. Though neither is quick to shortchange his maker, the boys have a different answer for what allowed them to survive. And it's this answer that I believe to be closer to the truth. It was song, they'll tell you, that sustained them. They sang these songs to the pale-faced moon above, and in their windswept madness they believed the silver moon was singing back at them. They wrote with an intensity matched only by the great grey ocean herself. When the winds blew hard and the rain beat down, they only sang louder. And the waves threatened to wash them both away. They tied themselves together, and they raised their voices above the scream of the sea. They sang, and they survived. Finally washed ashore, they kissed the ground and wept sweet tears of relief. They had no clue where in the world they were, and so were grateful to hear, at least according to George, a crude version of the Queen's English being spoken. It took them a good year to restore their constitutions, their proper skin tones, their waistlines. Sadly, though, land proved no easier for them. And there was a moment where they almost parted ways. But thanks be to Amun-Ra, they stuck together. It wasn't easy, though.
It was awful. We couldn't find any work.
No one wanted to employ us.
Apart from singing, our skill sets don't overlap in the slightest. I'm more of a managerial type, a visionary, like
listen,
a thinker.
Listen, Josiah would get those jobs that you'd give the tired old mule in the backyard.
That's not true.
It may seem strange that it took them so long to see it, but eventually they came to realize that the only thing they were any good at was singing. Literally, every other trade they tried caused only anger and frustration in those around them. But when they sang, why, Lord, even the sweet angels above swooped down to listen. How could men, so rough around the edges, with such tempestuous pasts, sing with such tenderness? How could men, who seem so incapable of producing anything of any tangible value, write a melody and a turn of phrase capable of softening the very stones we stand upon? They say that one should only be a musician if he or she absolutely must, if he or she has completely run out of options. Well, that was clearly the case for George and Josiah. When all other endeavors went literally nowhere, all that remained was song. And so they sang. And it turned out that the people wanted to listen. The crowds came. They danced, they sang along, they gave them their savings, they opened their halls and houses, they shared their food, they shared their beds. Our heroes were at first stunned. They were grateful. Then they were relieved. It turned out that redemption was inside them all along. It was that which came the easiest that would prove the most rewarding. They had found a calling, and they knew what they needed to do.
We had to find some way to get back to our boat, to see if she was still there. Miraculously, after all those years, she remained right where we had left her, rocking in the New Bedford Harbor, not far from where Cobbler's Hill rises up from the sea.
It's crazy that she hadn't just fallen apart, or been sold for scrap, or just burned. But she was still there, and we cried. died when we saw her.
They would make a few improvements to the vessel. They would think more carefully about what to pack. They would bring aboard fully strung guitars. They would even roll an upright piano aboard. They would name themselves after the vessel that had sustained them. They would take again to the water. For the world needed to hear these voices, and the raft was the means by which they would sing for the world. Well, dear friends, if that were only the end of our story. But alas, this is only where our adventures begin. The sea was just as cruel in the eastern direction as she had been when they were heading west. And it was not as easy as they had hoped to make a living on music back in those days. Indeed, I hear it is still not so easy. And so, while they were singing wherever and whenever and for whomever they could over the next decade, George and Josiah were also crisscrossing the globe looking for work and wisdom and woman, engaged in all sorts of other endeavours, pursuing all sorts of harebrained projects. But that is all for our next episodes. For now, let us leave them upon the smooth seas with a following wind. There they are. Can you see them, fair listeners? I surely can. There they are, back aboard their craft, rising with the rolling swells, eyes on the horizon line, and hearts united in hope.
Looking back, it's where it all began. We crossed the ocean for another land. And we heard a song through the salt and stars. It went blow, wild winds blow. Lord, you know, I've been sinking low. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, wild winds blow me far from home.
Signing off, I have been and will remain Elias B. Worthington, your guide on this journey. If you'd like to drop us a line, please mail your missives to the attention of the landlord of the Spaniards Inn, above which I currently reside.